Writer and Native American from Leech Lake Reservation, David Troyer, last year published Res Life, an important work on many levels. He is the author of three novels, with one previously published collection of essays. Res Life is his first full-length work of nonfiction and was recently released in paperback. In the book, Troyer addresses tough and controversial subjects like treaty rights and relations with non-Indians and the corruption and shortcomings of tribal governments and leadership. He skillfully weaves valuable historical data into narratives that tie the large historical and legal issues he writes about to the lives of contemporary Indians living in Minnesota. David Troyer appeared at the Cass Lake Library in February of 2012 to talk about and read passages from Res Life. Here are highlights from that event.
But in 2007, my grandfather died, Eugene Seeley. And it was really a painful thing. It was too sudden. It was by his own hand. And it was quite a shock, you know, for everyone. And my grandmother asked me to do a couple things. When I drove up here real fast, I was living in the cities then, and I drove up, you know, I was up here that evening. The next morning, she asked me to do two things. She asked me to clean up the house where it happened. And my uncles, you know, it was too much to ask, you know, my uncles for them to do that. And she asked me if I'd write the eulogy for his service. And I said yes to both. And both things were really hard, you know. And it was really hard not to feel that this was somehow a tragedy. I was really despondent about the whole thing. I couldn't see any upside to any of it, you know? I couldn't see anything other than what he'd done and, you know, how sad we were, but how mad we were. We were pretty mad. You know, I was mad. My mom was mad, you know? We were looking forward to kind of a natural cycle, you know, of life. And I felt cheated, you know? I was upset by that. So, I did what she asked and I cleaned up the place. And then I set about to thinking about the eulogy, you know. And eulogies are particular kinds of documents, right? They're really an odd thing. They're really hard to do. And I have to say, you know, I've given readings all over the country, and I've given talks all over the country, and I've given talks and readings, and I've been lucky, you know, overseas, and Australia, and all over the place. But man, I've never been so nervous in my life when I had to sort of talk to our family in the Deer River Church at his funeral. I've never been so nervous in my entire life. And I don't know what I was going to say. You know, I don't know what I was going to say that would be... Because eulogies have to do two things, right? You have to remember who's passed in some way that's accurate. So that the people that are there know that you know who that is that's in front of you, you know? And, you know, our family's lots of things, but we're not saints. Well, there's one saint in my family. That's Megan. Megan's a saint. And I think that's why she wears roller skates half the time, so it keeps her sort of from floating away, you know, sort of with her wings and her halo and all that stuff. But the rest of us, you know, we're not perfect people. That's not a bad thing. That's just a fact. And my grandfather was not a perfect person. So how to say something about him that's true, you know, that respects his complexity, his unique way of being in the world, and he was a stubborn guy. My mom tells a story once when they were they counted out their change jar, and they had 35 cents left, you know, in the family for everything, for food, for everything. 35 cents. Grandpa Gene took it and took off and came back a while later, and he had a plaque that said "God shall provide" on it, and Grandma Lou was not happy. Right. And so she, I guess they had some flour and some water, and so she made some flour biscuits, and my grandma did, and that's what she fed all the kids, and she fed them first, which I gather was unusual. And Jean's waiting there, Grandpa's waiting there, his plate's empty, he's waiting, you know, all the kids get their biscuits and he's waiting, and she plops that plaque down on his plate, and she says, if he's gonna provide, eat that. You know. And he was not easy you know, at least not in my experience of him. When we were kids, you know, we'd all our cousins, you know, we'd all be playing and sort of just like this wind that sort of blew around Bina, you know, and we'd be blown out of people's houses and sort of we'd come into my grandpa's house and he'd be sitting there in his chair smoking a Pall Mall. He'd look at us and he'd get that little squint. I think he must have picked that up in World War II because he just would say, "Get the hell out of here." You know, we just take off running, you know. We didn't even slow down sometimes. We just, you know, and then just keep going. And he was tough, you know, he's a tough guy. He was a complicated guy, you know. So how could I explain that, right? Respectfully, you know. Not just paint some rosy picture, you know, but really describe who he was. So eulogies have to do that, you know, I think. The other thing they have to do, that's the first thing, and the second thing they have to do is they have to be of some use. Because eulogies are ultimately for those of us who've been left behind. That's who they're for. They're not for the deceased. They're fine. They're fine where they are. It's for us. And so I had to say something that provided some, you know, something of some use to the rest of us, you know. And so as I was trying to sort that out and write that eulogy for my grandfather, it occurred to me that what I was trying to do in that eulogy, trying to do those two things, was the same thing I was trying to do in this book. I was trying to say something that was true about not just where I'm from, but in general, you know, about reservations in general, something that was true, that didn't skate over the tough stuff, that didn't either sink into you know, some sort of despondent, depressed approach, or didn't just talk about hope and all the good things and ignore the difficult things that we do have to face that are true, you know, about where we're from. Reservations are complicated places, just like all of us are complicated people. I realized I needed to capture that. And the other thing I realized I needed to do was to write something that was useful. Just as in a eulogy, it's for those of us who are here. I wanted to write a book that was useful for those of us who are here, that was successful in trying to see our experiences in some other way than we've been seeing them. It was really important to me.
That's David Troyer, author of the 2012 nonfiction book called Res Life, speaking at the Castlake Library. To close the presentation, Troyer read a passage from Res Life.
This is right after, it kind of ends with my grandpa's funeral, the drive back from Deer River to the cemetery, and then just the thoughts that were occurring to me at that moment. I wanted to read a little bit about that, just to sort of show you where my thinking ended with the book. On the Davis funeral, I delivered the eulogy in the Catholic Church in Deer River, as my grandmother had asked me to do. Deer River is just over the reservation boundary. And I've actually wanted, because I think the sign for the boundary goes right through the middle of that laundromat in Deer River. And I always kind of wanted to wash my clothes there, just to see if they'd be different, depending on which washer I put them in, you know? People have crazy ideas. Like my younger brother, when he went to college, they said, "Where are you from?" He said, "Well, I'm from Leech Lake Reservation." And they said, "Well, how did you get over? How'd you get over the fence?" he said, "What?" And they said, "Yeah, wasn't there a big fence?" You know, and he said, "It's not Escape from Alcatraz." You know, but there's some crazy ideas. So I wonder, like, what would happen to my laundry, right? The priest wore his vestments, and the sash over his shoulders was beaded. Some good Ojibwe Catholic must have made it for him. It was really quite beautiful. I'd never spoken in a church before. I'd never been to Mass. I'd never been baptized. Christianity always seemed kind of strange to me. So different with the songs and the liturgy and the clothes. My Ojibwe religion, in comparison, felt much more vanilla, much more matter-of-fact. The medicine men I know wear sweatpants and baseball caps more often than not. There's a lot of laughter at those, and also a lot of dirty jokes, too. So I read my eulogy, and my cousin Derek read two passages from the Book of Lamentations. At the wake, when Father Paul had asked if one of us could read from the Bible, we'd all looked at each other in panic. "Well, I can't do that," said my brother Anton tactfully. "Maybe Nate can," Nate suggested. Sam. Sam thought perhaps Megan could do it. Everyone was either too shy, never having read aloud in public before, or too pagan, and so it would have felt kind of disrespectful to actually do it. Finally, Derek said, "Sure, I'll do it. I was an altar boy, for crying out loud." Derek usually wore baggy clothes, urban style, drooping pants, football jerseys, chains, ears pierced, his black hair is usually spiked, right? You guys know Derek Pernizos? Yeah, you know, so you know how he dresses, and at the church he was dressed, you know, in a suit, and he looked very proper, and when he spoke really well, and he did a really good job. When he was done, Father Paul had me stand up and deliver the eulogy, and after which we drove back from Deer River. The drive from Deer River to the cemetery seemed long, though it's not. It was a beautiful day. As we drove, I looked out at the ditches and remembered that for many years, as a member of the U.S. Forest Service, my grandfather had cut that grass and brush and applied Agent Orange to the trees growing too close to the power lines, dispensing the chemical out of a canister strapped to his back. He also said, "Agent Orange never hurt anyone. I was covered with it all summer long." It's like, "No, you're fine, Grandpa, you're fine. There's nothing wrong, you know." So, anyway. And the trees, still growing, still going about their single-minded business of growing up, 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 had been logged by my grandfather's grandfather, Charles Seeley. I thought of how, down Highway 8, my grandfather had shot a male lynx that was hanging around the dump, how he used to drink at the Bina Bar, how up the Winnie Dam Road, the dam itself had been built with Indian labor from Ravens Point, our ancestral village, labor brought across the lake on a steam-powered barge and put to work clearing the ground and driving the pilings and installing the sluices, and that when it was done, the water rose and flooded out the village on Ravens Point, flooded out the very people who built the dam, and that's why the village moved to where Bina is today. Everything around me had been shaped by us in that place for a couple hundred years. Everything I saw was saturated with family, with us, with him. The cemetery was no exception. We gathered near the grave I'd not dug because I was cleaning up the house. My cousins and brothers had dug it. It was like the many others that had been dug there, the same nice rectangle carved out of the sandy soil, soil that seems perfect for digging graves. There's hardly any room to stand. The ground is filled with the bodies of our family. My aunt and uncle, dozens of cousins and great uncles and great grandparents. I wonder how the ground can hold so many of our bodies. At times like this, I get a little depressed and I think that maybe we won't make it. There are too many of us who are dead for us to make it. Too many of us who are getting around to the business of dying too soon. It's a wonder, I sometimes think, that there is enough Indian land to hold us all, to hold our bodies. And it's hard sometimes not to feel in some fundamental way that we're all dead somehow, and that res life isn't so much a life as an excavation, one large grave that no one's bothered to fill in. But that's only when I'm depressed. Lost in these thoughts, I was standing to the side behind a few rows of mourners. I'd been a pallbearer, and so I'd had my time with him and I'd done my duty. My mother, who had yet to break down, leaned over and said, "Dave, you're stepping on Stan." So I was. Stan Matthews. And there, nearby, was Boobsy and Bumsy and the rest of my family. Vanessa, my cousin, my age. She was about as defiant and tough and sassy an Indian girl as you'll ever meet. She once pushed me off an embankment into a gravel pit and said, "Take that." She also said much later, "Blood is thicker than water." She died a week later. And my Uncle Sonny, who'd hunted deer from his bicycle. He didn't have a license. And when stopped by the warden, and the warden was trying to confiscate the deer, he whipped out the hunting regulation book, not the thin one, but the thick one, and he said, "There's nothing in here that says I can't hunt from a non-motorized vehicle."
I love it.
And the game warden had to agree. And so there went Sonny, pedaling down the road on his bicycle with the deer sort of splayed over the front of the handlebars. You know? Sonny, who was this guy who could read something once and have it memorized. Sonny, who was probably smarter than the rest of us put together. The guy who would go up to the front of the class, one of his classmates told me this, and when the teacher stepped out for a drink of water, would just scan the answer key on the desk and then go back to his seat, and he'd say all 30 answers right in a row with his eyes shut. Right, he had that kind of mind. And I began to wonder, maybe the miracle is not that the ground can hold so many Indian bodies, maybe the miracle is that it can hold so much personality. Because among the graves of my family and our village are the graves of our friends and neighbors and all these people and their stories and their lives, and there's so much personality here, so much. How can it hold it all? How much more can the ground hold? The answer, of course, is unfortunately always more. But as I looked around, it was easy to see that we're not short on personality above ground either. There's still plenty of that to go around. At Leech Lake, and everywhere else, too. None of it's dead. None of the people are dead. None of the sense they've made of their lives is dead. And on the reservation, at least, none of the whims, acts, and actions of presidents, Indian agents, congressional reformers, tribal leaders, or tribal citizens, or just people, are dead. Or if any of this is dead, it's certainly not buried. Nowhere more than in reservation life can we see, can we feel, the past as it still shapes the present. On the reservation, the past isn't even past. The coffin was down. Father Paul did what he had to do. The Leech Lake Color Guard was there, consisting of veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, the first Gulf War, and Afghanistan. They saluted and fired three volleys, the sounds disappearing over the lake. My cousins and I collected the spent shells and threw them into the grave, and then we bent to work with the shovels and covered up my grandfather. The funeral was Catholic because he was Catholic. The ground was Indian, and those who dug the grave are Indian, and the lake and the earth that surround it are ours and are Indian too. The Leech Lake Reservation Color Guard stood at attention, and the American flag flew alongside the Leech Lake Reservation flag, and I tried to see which one flew higher, but it was impossible to say for sure.
That's author and Native American from Leech Lake, David Troyer, in an appearance at the Cass Lake Library. At the event, Troyer talked about and read from his 2012 nonfiction book that was recently released in paperback titled Res Life.